This is Lawrence Tuning, and these are my 88 friends.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing you a song that will help me along. They're my one-man band. I'm the number one fan. Me and my 88. Me and my 88 friends.
Welcome to this special edition of Me and My 88 Friends. This is a show dedicated to celebrating the journey of faith and following Jesus. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host. If you don't know by now, I'm a songwriter and a singer and a preacher. And this show is special today for two reasons. First of all, my wonderful wife Trish is going to be my guest for the second week in a row as we play part two of a conversation that she and I had at our kitchen table about a week and a half ago. And the second reason is special is that we're going to share the backstory of the writing of my most well-known song, The Anchor Holds. This song was written during our New England years. We lived in Massachusetts from 1978 to 1994, and those were wonderful years in our lives. So I decided to open this episode today with a song about one of our great joys of living in Massachusetts, and that was going to see the Boston Red Sox, our beloved Red Sox. After 80-something years, the Red Sox finally broke the curse and won the World Series in 2004. It had been 1918 since they had won one. By the time they won the series, we had already moved to South Carolina. But my son and I rode a train to Boston and were there for the victory parade. So after going to that parade, I began to think about that experience. I also began to think about the excitement of when the second coming of Christ arrives. So I know it's a little strange, but I knitted those two themes together into a song about the Red Sox. This is called Worth the Wait. With a sigh. want to give you the backstory of this song, which has become a very well-loved song in America and even beyond. We've gotten letters and emails from all over the world from people who have told us that this song made a difference in their lives. This song was written through a lot of tears and a lot of heartache. So before Trish and I get into our conversation about the background and the circumstances, I want to play you my version of The Anchor Holds.
I have journeyed through the long dark night, out on the open sea. By faith alone, sight unknown, yet his eyes were watching me. The anchor holds, though the ship is battered. I have fallen down.
anchor holds. The anchor holds. The anchor holds. In spite of the storm.
We lived for 16 years in New England from 1978 to 1994, and it was a wonderful period of our lives for most of that time. All of our children were born there. My wife Trish found her niche in coaching sports. The ministry flourished there in many ways. We started a non-denominational church. It was a team effort, but it grew to a church of about 150 to 200 people. And everything was just wonderful. However, in 1992, Trish and I entered what we call now our year of sorrows. There was an accumulation of many sad things and stressful things that came into our lives. My father died that year. Trish was faced with potentially serious health problems, showing a lot of symptoms of lupus. Our baby girl had polyps removed. We had our third miscarriage, and a spirit of division and contention crept into our church, which we had poured our lives into for many years. Close relationships suffered during this time and even ended for Trish, and also for me. Some of our closest friends began to distance themselves from us and even end some of the friendships. Time has healed some of the wounds, but there are still scars that remain even after all this time. So this was a very difficult thing for Trish and I to reminisce and talk about the circumstances surrounding the writing of The Anchor Holds. After the miscarriage, I was given a six-month sabbatical from pastoring with pay, and it was during this dark, lonely, depressing time that I would go down and play the piano alone with God. In May of 93, I resigned from pastoring. The church gave us a level of financial support to help us get through the transition. However, it was not sufficient to meet all of the needs. I got a job in South Carolina because that's where we had decided to move, but I had to accept it in February, and the kids were still in school, and Trish had to stay there with the kids to try to sell the house and get the kids through school. That was a really tough time in a lot of ways. I sent my paycheck to her, but it wasn't enough really to meet all the needs. So we were really leaning upon the Lord, and it was a very fragile time in many, many ways. In July 1994, they all moved to South Carolina, and we continue to live here in South Carolina. So a week and a half ago, Trish and I sat down at our kitchen table and began to talk about those difficult, painful years of 1992 through 94.
When we first moved to New England, I started teaching and refereeing softball and field hockey. I did a lot of the men's leagues. I was one of two women umpires at the time in central Massachusetts. And Digital Corporation, I did a lot of their softball A, B, and C leagues, and then started working into the high school. And eventually, when we moved to Clinton, I was offered a coaching job at Clinton, so I coached track and field hockey there. I had an athletic background, and so many of my friends, at the time we played sports together, we played adult leagues of various kinds, softball, volleyball, whatever. And so this was a real normal part of my life that had come back after years of being on the road, missing sports, organized sports. And I told Lawrence at one point that I could do that the rest of my life and be really happy. Didn't make a lot of money at it, but loved it. Also taught at the private school where my children went. It was LaBrie had influenced several women to start a private school, and my children went there, so I did some classes for them as well.
And the way we were set up, even in Indiana, was we didn't have a, quote, senior pastor. We felt like the elders and the pastors were sort of the same function. I was the most prominent speaker. I was the first guy there and all of that. So 1992 was what we have looked back and we call our year of sorrows. Things just started growing difficult. I'll call it that, difficult. We had had two miscarriages before that. Three children, two miscarriages. And pastoring had become, little by little, a duty rather than a joy. It was really, it's very tough to be a pastor. I feel like I had a grace on me doing that. That wasn't the original calling, though. But various church issues and church decisions and just the interaction between various people, very draining thing. And we were starting to feel something was changing. Something wasn't quite like it used to be. So we had all of these stressors on us, and then I'm going to let you talk a lot about this, Trish. We went to the doctor. You'd gotten pregnant the sixth time. So you want to pick it up from there, what the doctor told us?
Yes. My last checkup with this doctor in Shrewsbury, Dr. McGee, said that everything looked good. It was good to go and out of danger and to live my life normally. For those that really suffer miscarriages and difficulty getting pregnant, I have great empathy. Nikki, our oldest, was born 7 years after we married, and it was a textbook pregnancy. I ran, I coached, felt great during that pregnancy and delivery. And after that, I became pregnant, and it was a peculiar kind of miscarriage where I had to report into the doctor that they were checking me for cancer. And from that point on, I was never the same. And when I found out that the doctor that delivered my first two children was an abortionist, I decided to change doctors. And that was difficult because at that point I'd had two miscarriages and I was a high-risk person, and I had found this new doctor in Shrewsbury that was very supportive.
Let me just put it there. I don't know if he did abortions, but he would refer you.
No, the first doctor was an abortionist as well. And I did not know that. I had volunteered a good bit at Birthright, which was a pregnancy support center. And I did not know at that time until later that he did abortions on the side. So when I changed, Dr. McGee was my doctor for the fifth and the sixth pregnancy. And so with our next two, I was bedfast for 5 to 6 months with both of those to be able to carry them. So with the experience of walking through those times with the Lord and asking the Lord, teach me how to grieve, teach me how to do this so that I become more like you and not bitter or disillusioned with my walk with you, he began to show me how to walk through those times, because I never knew how to go through something that I had not experienced. So with the last pregnancy, I was with one of my best friends. We were at Creation in Pennsylvania, and I began to feel really sick and miscarried shortly thereafter. The baby boy was 14 weeks. He was the size of my hand, perfectly formed, beautiful, down to his little fingertips. So it was a shock. I had already begun to have some burnout with the ministry a little bit myself. I've always been a one-to-one type person. I helped start the children's program at our church when it became large enough to have a nursery and children's program, and helped with the women's retreats and Bible studies and prayer meetings with women. So it's more of a one-on-one, small group type person. But I had worked several lengthy counseling sessions with some women. Began to feel really tired, in a combination of factors. After the baby was born, I was very, very ill, and was sent by our primary physician to a lot of specialists where they tested me and came up with nothing conclusive until I went on Plaquenil and stayed on that drug to try to stabilize my conditions. But it became very hard to function. After the miscarriage, was quite ill, and then when Lawrence left 6 months ahead of me to move to South Carolina, and I had the children and trying to work without the help of some really wonderful Christian friends, don't know that I would have made it financially or physically, because the disease was raging at that point.
You had the miscarriage and Massachusetts. She had been to Creation Music Festival, Pennsylvania. But the day of the miscarriage, it was July 1992, you began to have some symptoms for a week or two, I think. I remember crying out to God, praying, getting up in the night, praying for things to stabilize. And that particular day that the miscarriage happened, the third miscarriage, I was away. There was a member of our church who was a traveling salesman, and his route was in Rhode Island that day. Rhode Island's only 45 minutes away from where we were living. So once a year, he and I would go along with him, and we would just fellowship. So I was in Rhode Island, and you went to a state park, I think, with the mm-hmm. kids to swim and that
yeah,
sort of
some
thing.
Of my friends, we went to a lake to swim. And that's when I really actively started miscarrying.
And so I called in the afternoon from a payphone. Yeah, cell phones weren't even invented back then. And I stopped at a phone booth to call Trish to tell her that I would be about an hour late for supper. And your brother, Dan, who lived next door, answered the phone. He was with our kids, and he said, "I got bad news for you, Lawrence. It appears that Trish is having a miscarriage. They rushed her to the hospital in Worcester." And I remember crying out to God as I raced to Worcester, begging God, "Lord, please let us have this child. It's been a rough year. My dad died, and all the stresses of burnout as a pastor and everything. Can you please let us have the baby?" I think at that time there were like 14. Our church was young couples, so I think there was like 13 or 14 women who were pregnant at the time. And just begged God to let us keep this baby. And when I got there, I walked in, and Trish turned to me and said, "Did you hear the news? We lost him. He was a little boy. And the nurse thought you might like to see him." And our little 14-week unborn son was wrapped in a little blanket, and I held him in my hand. And I looked up at the ceiling and began to cry. And I remember saying to the Lord, God, I've loved you since I was a kid. I still love you, but I don't understand you. I don't understand your ways. I don't understand why things have to be this hard. And later on, when the song The Anchor Holds came, there's a line in the second verse that says, I've had visions, I've had dreams. I've even held them in my hand. I've had some people say, why didn't you say hands? But that was referring to holding that little baby, that little unborn son in my hand and seeing that dream slip through. It was a tough, tough day. And it led to some really soul-searching, tough times, really, with our faith. Not that we lost our faith, not that we got bitter at God, but just the confusion of it all. We had to really wrestle. We had to cling, because we really went through a storm, and even a greater, a continuation of the storm later on. But you want to share kind of what you went through with the miscarriage, or your thoughts, or...
Well, during that time, with this being my sixth pregnancy, I had well-meaning but not so smart people tell me things with the other miscarriage. Well, they're a little angel in heaven, or you must have done something wrong, or you get a lot of very bad comments from Christians and people who aren't Christians because they feel like they need to say something.
Or they say you didn't have enough faith. If you'd had right. more faith, this wouldn't have happened.
And during this period of time, the doctrine of name it and claim it was so prevalent. And I know that with the second and third pregnancies that I was bedfast with, every day was a matter of prayer that I would not lose those children. And I had complete faith that those children are going to be born. And they were. Our son was rushed to Mass General, but he survived. And he's fine today. And our baby girl was born early, but she is fine today. So it was perplexing to me why I could make it through and then other ones I did not. And I began to blame myself. I think many women who lose babies have guilt. They struggle with their faith. Why did God not answer my prayer and yet answered somebody else's? Two other leaders in the church, their wives were pregnant. We were all due at the same time, and oddly enough, with baby boys, and they had theirs. I wondered, Lord, what did I do wrong to not be able to carry this little boy that we wanted so badly? I always thought four children, two boys and two girls, was a perfect family. We loved children. So it was difficult. And then, in addition to that, the illness, the five symptoms of this autoimmune disease that increased and made it very difficult to function. So those were factors that I had to work through with the Lord. When I first miscarried, I remember going out to the woods behind our little house. It was a cottage on a lake that had been turned into a four-season home. And I said, Lord, teach me how to grieve, how to go through this with you. And he did, day by day. But this was the hardest one of all because there was so much thrown at us at once. We would just recover from one thing and another thing would hit. It was constant problems and difficulties beyond just the miscarriage that made things so much harder. And we lived, it felt like in a tornado. I've been around tornadoes growing up in Kansas, and it felt like we were in the whirlwind of a tornado many times. And it's hard to sort things out emotionally and spiritually when you can't recover from one major blow to another. I think one of the more difficult things is that our church was always known for a really loving, kind church, and there began to be such division and problems develop and people changing. And it was hard to function as a pastor's wife and get over the disappointment of losing a child and deal with a major illness all at once.
And we call that our year of sorrows because we had that going on. But as Trish said, there were problems developing in the church. And they really sort of came to a head around the same time that we had that miscarriage. And we went away for a couple of weeks. There was some growing dissatisfaction in the church with the leadership. Now, when I say the leadership, there were three of us in leadership together, but I was the most prominent in a lot of ways as far as being in the pulpit and that sort of thing. Wasn't the whole church. There was a segment of the church, though, that were voicing dissatisfaction with the leadership. There were a lot of areas that we waded through. Some of them were very valid. Some of them were areas of deep adjustment that we had to make in our leadership style and that sort of thing. But a really bad spirit came into the church. I don't know how to even describe it, but it was suddenly people were at odds that had always been friendly and that sort of thing. And that was a very hard thing to go through. There was losses of friendships. And it was like what I hear people talk about, going through divorce. And we were given a 6-month sabbatical. I didn't want to take it, but it was the advice of other people that were involved, that we were just burnt out and worn out, and we just needed to take a break from things. That 6-month sabbatical was a very dark time. It wasn't a fun time. I've told people, if you go on a sabbatical, make sure it's in the summer. Don't go in the fall when you've got to take carpool to the kids to school every day. But it was during that time that The Anchor Holds was written. I'm going to share more later on about the specifics of the song and how that happened. But it was a dark night of the soul. Both of us felt at times an absence of being able to feel the presence of the Lord. And that was always easy for me as a kid. I came to the Lord as a kid. I always felt close to the Lord. I always felt he was near. But there were times when he seemed very far away. Am I safe to say that with you? I know it was with me.
Oh, it was. There was two things that happened during that time that were helpful. I felt a lot of guilt that my faith wasn't strong enough to carry the 6th pregnancy through, and also that I was succumbing to this illness. Our family doctor was a good Catholic man, and he told me on a follow-up appointment that he had a lot of charts on his desk, and he put his hand on the charts, and he said, every morning before I see patients, I put my hands on these charts, and I pray for wisdom. And he said, I want to tell you, I think he could sense the guilt and failure that I was feeling. And he said, I want to tell you that you're a success because I have 5 children and I am praying that they get to heaven, but you already have 3 that are there. And it helped me to see things through a different perspective. And we named the little boy Colin Patrick, and he will be with us one day in heaven. Another thing that was a good factor during this time for me is in all the chaos and the confusion and this disgruntlement, the practical side of me finally came out, and I said, let's take a look at what's really going on with the members of our church. And I said, let's meet with them. And we met with every family. And it boiled down to basically 11 people. I had always had really good relationships with the women in the church and people. And it was difficult when some of those people turned on us. But at the time of the miscarriage, and when I came home, I was sitting on my couch. I'd just gotten home, and one of my friends came over, and she said, hey, bud, just here. I want to see you, but if you don't want to see me, that's okay. She said, we can talk, or I can just sit here, whatever you want, but I'm here. And it meant so much to me because she wasn't there to give advice. She wasn't there to tell me how to feel. She was just there. And I think the best thing that started to come back with time was the presence of the Lord. It was difficult for Lawrence and I to feel like if you pray hard enough, good things will happen, especially if you know what the Lord wants. So some things we just had to let go, and that was very hard because when we moved to New England, it became our life, it became our family, it became our work, it became everything, and to see it slipping away piece by piece and all the other things that went with it, it's like, can anything from this year be good? And I remember we went to see Lawrence's parents for Christmas, and it was the last day of the year, and we both said, we will be so glad when this day is over with. This year is done. And my brother, who was watching our house, called and said, hey, guys, I hate to tell you this, but your house has been broken into. And
well, the last day
of the year. Last day of the year, they had broken through a window and ransacked the house. So we were like, well, there you go. That's our year. But in the time swallowing, it was amazing to us, the amount of people and the true colors of some of our friends that just really came through for us, that provided support and love. One of the things that meant so much to me during the time is our finances were devastated with not having an income and me being sick. It was a struggle to work. And one of our good friends provided opportunities for me to work at his warehouse. And I remember he said, there's this huge tree that would be wonderful. Why don't we go get it and cut it up? This is when Lawrence was gone. I was afraid I was going to run out of wood for the winter, because that's what the way we heated, and provided this beautiful red oak tree that got us through the winter with the most amazing smelling heat in our wood stove. So just little things that were big things during that time, just little acts of kindness went a long way and began to pull us out of a very dark time.
It just seemed like our church was at loggerheads, and something else was going on, though. It was like, I didn't recognize it at first, but this whole issue of feeling burnout and the joy seeming to leave, and then the problems and all that, God was using that to create a dissatisfaction, I think, in where we were, because God was moving us to a whole new phase of our lives. My heart had always been evangelism and songwriting, singing, going out and speaking different places. A friend of mine told me one time that God can give you a grace to do something for a specific period of time. That doesn't mean it's a lifetime thing. And that's certainly what happened. I wasn't forced to resign. I wasn't asked to resign. But we felt the Lord was leading us to resign. The anointing was moving. It was like the cloud was moving to a whole new phase of ministry. Right after the sabbatical had ended, but I had not yet resigned, I went to Indiana And I met with a group of pastor friends who I'd known for a good while. And one pastor was praying for me. And he said, "Lawrence, I see a picture in my mind of childbirth going on. And the baby struggling to be born, the mother struggling to give birth to this baby. And the doctor says it's a breech birth. And he reaches in and turns the baby to get it in place so the birth could happen." He said, "In the same way, I believe the Lord is saying that your ministry, you're trying to give birth to something new. And it's in breech position. And to keep on going exactly like you're going right now, this thing that God's trying to birth could die." And so God is reaching in and he's changing situations in your life to make way for the birth to happen. And I went back to Massachusetts, and within about 2 weeks, after spending a whole day in prayer, Trish and I both felt it's time to resign, that trying to pastor on here is breach. It's just not going to have the blessing of God like it has been. It's better to go with what God's doing new than to hang on. And I've thought about that at times, the way God uses adversity sometimes to get us in his will. I believe if we had started a mega church and nothing had ever gone wrong, it would have been very hard for me to decide, okay, we need to move to South Carolina. And right after that time, the song "The Anchor Holds" was finished and the door opened up for it to be recorded nationally. So it happened after the resignation, a week later. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host of this show, Me and My 88 Friends. We've been listening to a conversation that my wife and I had about a week and a half ago as we recounted the painful year we went through that brought about the writing of The Anchor Holds. We had taken a sabbatical for 6 months. That was a lonely, lonely, dark time. I happened to see this in my diary last night, dated Tuesday, September 22nd, 1992. I wrote these thoughts in that dark time. "I've been longing all over again to see God bless the songwriting. My heart cry is, Lord, at this late stage of the game, at 43 years old, after string of dashed hopes, is there a place for this music to flourish? Is there a stream, a niche for it? I hope so." Words of a possible new song came to mind the other day while playing the keyboard. "The anchor holds, though the ship's been battered. The anchor holds, though the sails are torn. The anchor holds in spite of the storm." It's interesting that I wrote that down. I don't usually write things down like that. But that song came as I would sit at my keyboard and just grieve and pray. And I found myself it just came out of nowhere. And as we said, it was about a week or two after I resigned. I think it was actually 1 week. I rode from Massachusetts up to Bangor, Maine, because Ray Bolts was doing a concert there. I had known Ray since he was a teenager. He actually prayed to receive Christ at one of my concerts. And so I went there, and Ray and I got together to fellowship a little bit after the concert, actually even before the concert. And just in conversation, I shared with him what a tough year it had been and that I'd written this song, "The Anchor Holds." I didn't think anything of it because songwriters don't usually use other people's songs. So that was it. We had a nice time of fellowship. After I resigned, of course, I had just resigned, but I woke up in the middle of the night in the summer, and it was almost like I was in a cold sweat. This fear came over me, and I started wondering, how am I going to make a living? How am I going to provide for my family? I'm out of a job now. And in the middle of the night, it was like 3 a.m, and I felt like the Lord just whispered in my spirit, that still small voice, felt he said, I'm going to use your music to help you financially. And I have to tell you that I said to the Lord, I said, Lord, I've had so many disappointments as a songwriter. It's not like I doubt you, but I don't know. I don't ask you for signs, but I almost need a sign. I want you to know the very next day the phone rang and Ray Bolts called and said, I can't get the song about the anchor off my mind. Would you care if I recorded it possibly? And I told him, it's a very long song, Ray. You have my permission to shorten it and make whatever changes you need. And I sent it to him in the rough. He took it and changed a few things. One of the verses he turned into a bridge. And when we signed the contract, it was like 90% me and 10% Ray as the writer. Ray put it on that album and later wanted to put it on the radio, and the company refused to release it on the radio. They said, it's not a radio song. It'll never work on the radio. And Ray lobbied hard for them to change their mind, and they did. They put it on the radio, and within 3 weeks, it was number one, and it stayed at number one for 3 weeks, and I think in the top five for 6 weeks. And since then, it's taken on a whole life of its own. Many people have recorded it. Many people have come to me and told me that in the terrible crisis they were in, this was a song that kept them going. And many people have sung it at funerals. So we've been totally shocked at the response, and we're so grateful to God that even in the worst of times, He can bring good out of it. Anything you want to say in closing, Trish, regarding to anybody who was maybe discouraged or feeling an absence of the Lord's presence or confused or feeling like the best years are over?
Probably a year of solid problems and difficulties made me feel like I was not coping and not spiritual enough. A lot of it, I turned inward that it was my problem, that I wasn't good enough to overcome it. And in difficulties that are overwhelming, sometimes all we can do is stay steadfast and look to the Lord who will bring us through, trusting in Scripture and not in feeling, that He is the God who says He is, and to let Him prove that to us. And it's not always that He is going to answer our prayers in the way we want them answered or the way we believed they would have been answered, but the way He sees fit. And my life had turned out to be very different. I left teaching and coaching, the two things that I really loved, and sat for my state boards and became a medical social worker for 27 years. But the life here allowed us to really focus more on the children and be restored and let God teach us new avenues of what He wanted to do in our lives together and as a family and in the churches that we've belonged to since then. It's wonderful to be a support person in a church and not a leader and encourage people, because we've been there and we know how it feels. So trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not into your own understanding, and He will direct thy paths. It's definitely been a scripture that's been proven over and over to us. The good things in my life is that leaving the sports that I love so much there opened up new opportunities here to learn new sports and new friendships. But the main thing that I count as a victory and a blessing from the Lord is that my health has been restored. I have not been on any medication since that first year. And the Lord has shown me ways to protect my health. I've always been interested in natural foods and gardening and health, and it has encouraged me to keep exploring those things to help my family be healthy and myself to be healthier mentally and physically. So good things come out of adversity. Keeping steadfast and keep walking one day at a time has helped us to get through the most difficult year of our lives. And I know people go through far worse than what we went through, but God has been faithful, and He has answered so many prayers that I could never fault Him with anything that happened. And I feel that even as we get older, we are more and more blessed because the Lord is close. One thing that has been a blessing to both of us is our ability to pray together and to do spiritual warfare for things that are immovable and be able to watch God do miracles when we could not do those for ourselves.
It's been a joy to sit and reminisce with my wife Trish for these past two episodes as we've looked back on the faithfulness of God even in the midst of some dark times that we've gone through. I've heard a lot of versions of the Anchor Holds over the last 25 years, but I want to close the show with one of my favorite versions, which is from a 24-year-old English man named Charlie Green, who was a semifinalist in the show Britain's Got Talent. This is the Anchor Holds, sung by Charlie Green.
Anchor holds, though the ship is battered. The anchor holds. anchor holds. Though the ship is battered, the anchor holds. Though the sails are torn,
my